Thanks so much for being here. And without further ado, I'd like to pass it on to Mr. Nader. Thank you.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you very much, Sean. Thank you all for coming. The pizza will be our sole concession to Pavlovian science, by the way. And I hope you enjoyed it. I also want to thank the Harvard Law Record, which I was proud to be editor of years ago when we took on the big questions of the law, while the Harvard Law Review footnoted the more technical issues of the law. And also the Harvard Law School Forum, which was a very vibrant forum then, bringing in a lot of dynamic, controversial speakers. It's going to be revived again with the students' help, as well as other students who made this possible. The first annual Shake 'em Up Harvard Law School Day. We hope there'll be many more in the future. The students also wrote four short memos, which I urge the students to read, as well as anybody who wants to know more about what's going on at Harvard Law School. There was an intellectual atmosphere at the law school memo. There's a memo on critiquing the Harvard Law School curriculum. There's a memo on extracurricular activities, all the various groups and clubs, and also a memo on Harvard aid, student aid, fellowships and grants. And I think they've been distributed to the speakers, but you won't have any trouble getting hold of them. I want to thank the 12 speakers as well for their extraordinary expressions of experienced public interest advocacy. I estimated they have 400 years of experience. And 20, 30, 40 years ago, any one of them would have filled this room without any pizza. High school students, law school students. But we brought them together because it's important to give you an experience that will allow you not to have regrets when you go into law practice and you have to represent interests you're not particularly interested in representing, except that it makes a good living. And by the time you retire, 15,000 days later, 2,000 weeks, goes very fast, you will have serious regrets that you missed the justice train. And this proceeding will be videotaped so the students who aren't here can look at it at their leisure. I hope this model will spread to other law schools. There may be some students from Bay Area law schools here, or from Yale, and we hope that there will be a Shake 'em Up Yale Law School Day and on across the country. I always have had a high estimate of the ability of law students to spark the conscience of the profession, which now has 1.2 million licensed attorneys in the United States. Most law students are not aware of that, that they can spark the conscience, that they are the conscience of the profession. They have no axe to grind. They look at issues of justice, injustice, more clearly, and they are not so prone to self-censor themselves as you will surely be exposed when you go into a major law firm. You will become very expert in self-censoring yourself. The important point here is that there are enough jobs for you in public interest law. The surveys show that law students want to do public interest law. But there's legal services, of course. There are some practitioners who almost define public interest law. Let's say they're breaking open new areas of product liability. Well, by and large, there aren't enough jobs. I think any profession worthy of its name should have 10% of its practitioners looking out for the total mission of the profession beyond the narrow dictates of commercial practice, whether it's architects, accountants, engineers, or others. It's also important to note that there are already models operating out there. This is the history of the Public Citizen Litigation Group, which I started with Alan Morrison, who taught here at the law school. And there are very few histories of public interest law firms, the kind of cases they've taken, the Supreme Court cases that were argued by 28, 29-year-old lawyers. Try doing that in a big corporate law firm. And so they're up there now. They're very reasonably priced at $10. The second thing is that one of my classmates, Paul Tobias, out of Cincinnati, he couldn't be here, but he's coming in for the reunions. When he graduated, he noticed that there was really no systematic skilled representation of workers who weren't unionized. And they were the majority then, even a greater majority now. And he started a group called the National Employment Lawyers Association, which now has over 2,000 practitioners. And their general mission is to build a cadre of first-class employment law specialists able to satisfy the needs of individual employees in workplace matters. And that's, I think that's out here on this table, the description of it. But although your elders in the profession have a severe responsibility to expand public interest law opportunities for you, you have to first provide them with a higher estimate of your own significance as law students. You are not mere technicians. You are not mere skilled representatives of powerful interests. You are lawyers. You will be, not just attorneys. I never had that distinction discussed. An attorney is a licensed person given a monopoly with other attorneys to represent clients in courts of law. They are torn. At the same time, you have to be a lawyer looking out for the improved administration of justice. That's what your code of ethics enjoin you to do. They are not just pretty lists of good things that lawyers should comply with to be put up on your office wall. They represent unique responsibilities of the profession you've been given to advance the administration of justice writ large. That means the branches of government, that means private power interests, that means the state of the prisons, the state of our criminal courts, the process of juries, etc. Now, it's good to look back at what the law students did in the 60s and 70s without over-idealizing them. But they woke up. They woke up because their conscience, along with the conscience of their faculty, were illuminated by riots in the city from desperate people. Detroit, Newark. They were illuminated by civil rights advocates being hunted down by sheriff dogs and beaten. They were illuminated by the opportunity to participate in these summer exercises in the South. Selma Summer, for example. They were illuminated because some of the law students themselves were plaintiffs. Many law students wrote briefs. Many law students demonstrated. Some were beaten and sent to jail, and then came back and related their experiences to other law students. So you can see a lot of the improvement here at Harvard and elsewhere came from the agitation of students. You have a far better and broader and deeper curriculum. You have more diversity among students. You have some faculty that actually bridge the difference between teaching the formalities of law and the realities on the ground, as well as articulate some of your opportunities after graduation. Sometimes students even challenge the corporate law school recruiters. Mark Green, class of 70, couldn't be here today, but he related how he led a group of law students who developed a questionnaire for all corporate law firms. They wanted to know about pro bono. They wanted to know about how you could take your conscience to work and refuse to work, say, for a tobacco client without being penalized. They wanted to know a lot about the law firms that the law firms were not divulging. But because the students were organized, the law firms, in great majority, answered those questionnaires. Now, Mark Green is perfectly willing to help you, provide you with ideas for our 2013 law school questionnaire. It's a good exercise for the students as well. Now, when I was in the law school, all these changes were considered impossible. I was in a class of 550 students, 15 women, grudgingly admitted, and a far greater number of women than actually African Americans or other minorities. In other words, it was a total white male clutch. And if you ever thought then that the body of Harvard Law School would be as diverse as it is now, they would have laughed at you. The law professors were the best and the brightest. If you didn't believe it, you just had to ask them. And they basically said, with very few exceptions, that let's be practical. Women will take up seats of men, and then they're going to go graduate, marry, have babies, and leave the profession. And that's not the purpose of the Harvard Law School. Remember, they were the best and the brightest. It was also a situation where the Socratic method was used, with few exceptions, as a bullying device. It represented intellectual arrogance as a pedagogical mechanism. Very few professors used it to its finest purpose. Professor Warren Seavey of Torts was one of them. Professor Zachariah Chafee, who taught equity, a course no law student should graduate without taking a course on equity, used it beautifully to open up the students' minds instead of crushing, which is what the Socratic method has often been used. You know, the Socratic method is a game only one can play. I'm sure you realize that by now. The curricula was a reflection of the corporate job market. Here's how it worked. You had courses on securities law, property law, tax law, etc. Here's the courses we didn't have. We had no courses on the laws of peace. No courses on corporate crime, just street crime. No courses on environmental law. No courses on consumer protection. No courses on the condition of poverty. No specific courses on civil rights. No courses on the commons, the great property owned by all Americans, but controlled largely by corporations, like the public lands and the public airways. We did have a course entitled Landlord-Tenant. But we never got to the tenant. We had a course called Creditors' Rights, but not Debtors' Remedies. Because Harvard Law graduates didn't represent debtors and tenants. The jobs were representing creditors and landlords. It was about 5 months before the first student raised his hand and asked the professor in corporate law, why do we spend so much time on Delaware cases? Court of Chancery. And the professor said, because Delaware has established an intricate foundation for corporate law and the relations between the different parties. We were never told why most of the corporations chartered in Delaware. It was a very permissive jurisdiction. And we weren't even told that General Motors could buy Delaware in a weekend if DuPont was willing to sell it. The misdeployment of the profession was never discussed. Jimmy Carter said 90% of the lawyers represent 10% of the people. It's probably even worse now. How are we deployed as a profession to meet the needs of justice? We have a situation where we had a big controversy over to maintain one clinic. There's only one clinic. That's all. The conditions got better in the 60s and 70s, of course. And something else didn't get better. It got worse. The concentrated powers of corporatism, militarism, and commercialism penetrated our civic culture, subordinated it, and affected so much of what was taught and not taught at law schools. What was also not taught at law schools is how the law can be twisted into an instrument of repression. We've seen that, for example, in the credit area and what happened in the fallout from the Wall Street crashes. We do have crises. We have constitutional crises, which you'll hear about today, corporate crises, crises in procedural laws. The imperial presidents, for example, have been able to become prosecutors, judge, jury, executioners, all in secret, regarding military attacks abroad in any country and against any person that the president chooses. While the corporate state reflects the supremacy of giant corporatism, it continues to deepen its toxic roots here and abroad under the skilled counsel of corporate law firms. Never underestimate the significance of corporate law firms. The resolution that you have to explain this gathering goes into greater detail. Were we more professionally oriented, we would address more important subjects. The most important is, where are the lawyers in a time of massive illegalities, massive distortion of the law, subject to concentrated power abuses? The law does matter. Because we have not raised the minimum wage, 30 million workers today are making less than workers made in 1968, 45 years ago, adjusted for inflation. The law mattered in Western Europe when, after World War II, they gave all their people, repeat, all their people by law, 4 weeks paid vacation, higher, lower incomes than the United States, universal health insurance, better and cheaper public transit, stronger labor law protections, stronger pension rights, paid maternity leave, paid child care leave, paid family sick leave. And today, over 60 years after World War II, we have none of these laws for all the people. The laws do matter. Without justice, the law means oligarchy, plutocracy, rule by the few for the many. It means dispossession, repression, exclusion, and wholly avoidable impoverishment of the people. It means raiding posterity and depleting the biosphere. Why should any law students be surprised? They pretty much know all this. The question is, can they be all this in terms of the opposition, in terms of the creativity, in terms of the curiosity, and in terms of the imagination? Rest assured, your years here at Harvard Law School, if you're not careful, your incipient curiosity, imagination, and boldness will be channeled into preparing monetized minds serving retainer astigmatisms. Let me open the session with a few housekeeping. There has to be very strict time controls, 20 minutes for the speaker, 10 minutes for questions. We urge your questions or comments briefly. The presentations are necessarily summarized, but rest assured, each speaker has a huge storehouse of substantiation and elaboration. Some of the writings are up there in the books or here. Number three, the Shake-Em-Up Harvard Law School Day is something I hope that you will talk about and join with the other law students here in proliferating a number of events in the coming weeks and months. Number four, there are tremendous interests in this type of format. We've invited Lenny Grenier, Paul Butler, and others. They are otherwise committed, but they indicated they would like to participate in future such sessions. Number five, note the speakers and see what they accomplished and draw a unique conclusion, among others. See how much they accomplished with how little in terms of resources and personnel. That's very important for you to get an attitude that major changes that are long overdue in this country are a lot easier than we think if we have the right orientation, strategy, techniques, and self-respect as a profession. Finally, notice how many obstacles and austerity and conflicts they had to transcend. And notice how they developed a civic personality that immunized them from being discouraged, demoralized, and burning out. Those are very important for you to benefit from today.